Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 3 of Volume, or Issue 83 of Cosmos Magazine. And we're halfway through, or a little way through, to page 23, the feature article. It's about Einstein's, the sort of 100 years thing where Einstein's special theory of general relativity got a big tick. When it was, so he had his miraculously year in 1805, general relativity happened in 1905, 1915 he had general relativity, 1919 Eddington found that the little stars went behind the sun. Now, how he did that is that there's been a long established method in astronomy to look for stars as they've become occluded by objects and to measure them. And of course, a moon, you can look at the occlusion of stars any time of the moon, but when it's behind the sun, you can actually check for things. And so they've really got that there. Okay, it's now 100 years since Albert Einstein's burst onto the global stage like a supernova. Strictly speaking, the anniversary of his spectacular public debut is this November, but the occasion sparked. It was an extraordinary British scientific exhibition centred on the solar eclipse of May 1919. By November, the data had been analysed and results were in. Newspapers around the world announced a revolution in science thanks to the British astronomer's confirmation of Einstein's prediction that light bent is by gravity. Amazing. This was a radical new idea in the early 20th century. It was known that light is electromagnetic radiation, not a material particle, but Newton's physics, no mass means no gravitational interaction, ergo light should be unaffected by gravity. Not unsurprisingly, it was Einstein himself who suggested using a solar eclipse to test the strange prediction, which he made with his new general theory of relativity. The idea is that when the moon blocks out the sun and darkens the sky, the fixed stars in the part of the sky near the sun are visible, and that may be compared with the with experience, as he put it. He meant that to see whether or not light was from the star's bends as it passes through the sun's strong gravitational field and then reaches the Earth, astronomers could take a photograph of the apparent positions of the stars during the eclipse. This could then be compared to the photographs taken several months earlier or later, with Arthur Eddington picture, when the sun would be in a different part of the sky, so the light from the photographed stars would reach a cylindric line of sight. By all accounts, well, it's interesting. They are still in a direct line of sight, aren't they? But the line from us we perceive as bent. By all accounts, the 1919 eclipse exhibition returned a stunning result. If one fell swoop, it appeared to confirm Einstein's prediction and overturn Newton's venerable theory of gravity. It is not often that a new theory topples another so dramatically, especially a theory as successful as Newton's, which has passed virtually every test for more than 200 years. In this case, though, the timing was especially poignant, because it was the first year after the Great War a British team had experimentally confirmed a German theory. Arthur Stanley Eddington, the leader of the Eclipse exhibition and Quaker, hoped this would speed up the reconciliation of a world weary of war but still seething with resentment between the former enemy nations. But there's a catch to this famous and thrilling story. The excited newspaper announcements in November 1919 made Einstein into the first scientific superstar, launching him on a trajectory that would so soon capture the public imagination that 90 years later he was named Time magazine's Person of the Century. It was a good choice to make in 1999, when Einstein's theories had been tested many times to considerable precision, and his personal warmth and community engagement were legendary. In 1919, however, things were not so clear, and the publicity surrounding eclipse results inadvertently propagated the myth about science that had dogged it, and the exhibition itself ever since. Here I want to do two things: to celebrate the general theory of relativity and the recent 22nd of May centenary of the first experimental hurdle, and to highlight what the 1919 eclipse experiment and aftermath tell us about science, about how it's done, and what really means to be successful test theory. General relativity theory of relativity, generally relativity, or GR for short, was published at the end of 1915. The First World War had interrupted communications between German and British scientists, but Dutch physicist Wilhelm de Sitter managed to send his friend Eddington a copy of Einstein's new paper. Eddington was entranced by it. GR is perhaps the most beautiful scientific theory of all time, one of the most extraordinary creations of the human mind. I do think so. It's actually getting the full mathematical, it's just basically space with tensors as far as I can see. The special theory of relativity, which had come 10 years earlier, is so brilliant. It gave us E equals MC squared, and a response formulated the concept of time and space have no universal existence. Rather, they are artifacts of our consciousness. I like that. That's really good. And of the way we choose to measure them. In special theory shows how different observers can locate different events in time and space, if each moving relative to another with a constant speed. General relativity extends the theory about measuring the influence of gravity. This was no mean feat for 1915, before space travel was possible, because gravity is always with us here on Earth. With other forces, such as electromagnetism, you can build up a theory based on experiments that can show how one charged particle moved in the field of another, and so on. But you cannot really isolate the force between everyday objects. It is negligible compared with the Earth's gravitational field, which has a remarkable property that all materials and bodies are drawn down towards it at the same rate. This is, of course, Galileo's famous result. Newton's ingenious approach to the problem had been to look to the skies for inspiration. He had derived his inverse square law of gravity using Kepler's laws to roughly circular orbits of moons. Then, by making his bold hypothesis that our moon, like every other body, is falling towards or around the Earth, he was able to equate the circular acceleration of the moon with the known rate of gravitational acceleration of the Earth. His calculations showed pretty nearly the Earth's gravitational pull on the moon does indeed depend on the masses of the Earth and the Moon, which is pretty amazing because he worked out the mass of the Earth by picking up a rock in his garden. How about that? And several rocks he could have picked up, and he picked up the one which was just like the mean mass of the Earth. It's pretty amazing, or average mass density. He then showed the planets likewise pulled around by orbits of the Sun and gravity. The words roughly and pretty nearly are important in the context of 1919 tests. New theories must quantify the intuitive leaps that underlie them, but often there are technical limitations to equipment to use to test them. For instance, the difference between Newton's moon's calculations and his theoretical predictions was largely due to the inaccurate value available for lunar distance. And it turns out, the inverse square law of gravity is remarkably accurate when applied to most things in the solar system. Indeed, in 1915, the only known discrepancy between Newton's law and the actual planetary motion was the slow precession of the perihelion of Mercury. Newton's theory was out by a tiny 43 angular seconds a century. An angular second is an arc second, a 1/3600th. Of a degree, a minuscule amount that will prove critical for the analysing of the 1919 eclipse experiment. For this reason, as well as to fit the theory of gravity into a kind of relativistic framework that had worked so well in his special theory, Einstein approached the problem in a radically new way. His great insight was to recognise that we on Earth, in fact, imaginatively transform away the effect of gravity by changing our everyday frame of reference. This is interesting. I think it's more tenses which really go for me. This is tenses. Kepler's explanation of the structure of planetary systems, and they show his platonic spheres. His initial idea, pretty stupid, lame idea. It's interesting that he had a stupid idea, but people weren't interested. They were interested in his panache, I think. And imagine Okay. Our usual point of view is from a frame that is fixed firmly on the ground. But what if you were free to fall in an elevator, falling freely down an empty shaft, for example? Imagine that you're in a vertigo situation, and suppose you let go of the ball you're holding. A person standing on the outside watching this will see both you and the ball, along with the lift, continue to fall downward to the earth at the same rate. That is how falling objects behave when we view them from the terra firma. Relative to your falling elevator, however, the drop ball stays motionless, just as if there was no gravity acting on it at all. In other words, the reference frames of falling lift appears to be zero gravity, just as we see nowadays in videos of astronauts falling freely inside these capsules. Really, zero gravity or, I've just got to really remember what is it. They're not, they're zero G, so they've got, no, the G force is zero, but it's not zero gravity. It's pretty interesting. What this thought experiment showed Einstein was that he could indeed devise a relativistic theory of gravity, since we were able to make or unmake a gravitational field simply by changing the reference frames. And what this means is that the mathematical key to both relativity theories lies in knowing how to transform the space and time coordinates from a point of view one relatively to an observer to another, which is just general relativity, except you get a 16-rank tensor, you get a four-rank tensor, and then 16 ranks to do it. It took Einstein 10 long years after the fire to find the right mathematical language to its task to extend special relativity to general relativity, where the relative motion is not constant but accelerated, as it is when one is falling under the influence of gravity. What he found was quite a special relativity played out flat space-time. In addition, the gravity meant that space-time itself would have had to be curved. We are used to this idea now from the famous metaphor of the way fabric of a trampoline curves around a heavy bowling ball when placed on it. But in 1915, the idea that gravity curves space-time was incredible. So incredible, in fact, that many physicists showed little interest in it. This is despite the fact that GR accounted for those missing 43 arcseconds to the precision of Mercury's perihelion, the result that had made Einstein dizzy with joy. Nevertheless, for those who did show interest in the new theory, some hoped to disprove rather than confirm it. Giving up Newton seemed a step too far. One of the doubters was Sir Frank Dyson, Astronomer Royal. Einstein had first made a prediction of light bending in 1911, before he'd finalised his theory. A number of eclipse exhibitions had subsequently been planned were abandoned because of the outbreak of war. Ironically, it was a lucky for Einstein because, in 1916, had he improved his prediction using a new finished, he improved his prediction involving a new finished theory. His final estimate for the angle of bending or deflection of the sun was tiny, 1.7 arc seconds. Wow. Or 1.75 in modern values for the relevant physical constants. But Dyson realised that the solar eclipse of 1911 would be a perfect occasion to test him. Two suitable occasions were found for the eclipse would be total. Eddington Edward Cottingham's team went to a cocoa plantation in Rocasundi on Principal in West Africa under the Portuguese colonial rule, now a tiny independent island nation of Sao Tome e Principe. Wow. Well, there you go. That's a little nation, Sao Tome e Principe. I didn't know that's a new country. Andrew Cromwell and Charles Davidson went to Sobral in northeastern Brazil. Eddington, a distinguished Cambridge mathematician and astronomer, was one of the few people at the time who really understood GR, and critics would later say that he was so captivated by it that he was not an objective observer. As he pointed out in a 1919 article, though, his colleagues in the teams went to Brazil were very sceptical of Einstein's theory and inclined to expect a result opposed to it. Actually, Newton himself had speculated in a throwaway remark at the end of his book of optics that gravity would have a tiny bending effect on light because he thought light as being made of a tiny material particles. You can see the way gravity curves the path of material objects by throwing a ball horizontally and washing it down to the ground. In GR, however, it's not Newtonian gravitational force between the sun and the light particles that pull the light towards the sun, but the curving space-time around the sun. In 1919, it seemed too outlandish to take seriously. The formidable mathematics that underlies it didn't help win over converts to Einstein's new theory. It's just mind-bending. I might go back and look at study general relativity again. So the task of the British eclipse teams had set themselves was monumental: to collect data that would help decide the theory was correct, Einstein's or Newton's. On 29th of May 1919, the dense cluster of stars known as the Hyades was right, not the Pleiades, the Hyades, I don't know what they are, near the sun, perfect for the photograph during the total eclipse. However, the technical scandals involved in the task comprise a story of itself. They mainly consisted of telescopes and astrographs, devices comprised of telescopes and photographic plates with lenses especially designed to give a wide field of view. The total eclipse would last barely 6 minutes, during which time the astronomers had to be able to focus sufficiently to distinguish different stars and record good enough images to discern the photographs of plates' positions changed around 1/50th of a millimeter. 6 minutes may sound like a reasonable window of opportunity, but during that time the Earth itself would have moved noticeably because its spinning axis about its axis about 1,600 kilometers per hour. You can see the effect at sunset disappear below the Earth in a couple of minutes. The team's equipment needed to be able to keep track with terrestrial rotation so the tiny distant stars remained in focus. To make this a little more concrete, the sun's diameter is about 0.5 degree or 1,800 arc seconds compared with Einstein's tiny 1.7 arc seconds of light deflection. So it was very important to keep track of the moving Earth so not to blur the minuscule deviations Eddington was hoping to record, and others were hoping he could be ruled out. And then there was the weather. As Eddington reported, it had been beautiful, fine every day in principle except for the day of the eclipse. Luckily, during the actual eclipse, the cloud began to thin, and astronomers managed to see and photograph a few stars. At Stolball, the weather was better, but the team there had another problem. Cromwell set up and focused the main telescope the night before, but the excessive daytime heat caused the photograph plates and mirrors and telescope tubes to expand, which played havoc with the delicate calibrations. For example, expansion would change the telescope's focal length and scale of the plates, so any recorded change in the star's position during the eclipse could represent a different angular displacement from those calibrated on checks of the plates the night before, and on comparison photographs taken when the sun was far away from Hades. This made it impossible to get accurate values of the actual amount of light bending. Moreover, weather changes can introduce changes in atmospheric refraction. Refraction is bending of the path of light ray when it passes through denser medium. And it's easy to notice the effects when you immerse something in water. It's more difficult to discern atmospheric refraction, but some physicists believe that if there was any light bending to be seen in the eclipse photographs, it would be due to refraction, not to gravity. I've just got to really get my head memorizing all this. Over the next few months, astronomers sifted through the very limited data, painstaking applying analysis techniques such as least squares to standardize errors. Eddington was jubilant about the team's early result, which seemed clearly to favor Einstein. And by September, rumors had filtered through to Einstein himself via the Dutch physicist Henk Lorentz, Lorentz Force. Einstein quickly telegraphed a reply, "Heartfelt thanks to you, Eddington." And then he wrote to his mother telling him, "Joyous news, the British expeditions have actually proved the light deflection near the sun." By November, the data analysis was complete. Very soon, the world knew Einstein's theory was trumped Newton's. The rest, they thought, would be history. Back in early November 1919, however, when Dyson, Eddington and Cromwell first announced the result in London, the mixed response from scientists was at odds with the triumphalist announcement that soon followed in the press. In fact, doubts about the accuracy of the results, and, oh my God, an occasional accusation of bias continued to surface, not only at the time, but until recently. These doubts and accusations hinge on the lack of data and on the fact that the astronomers had obtained three different sets of results, only two of which were used in the final conclusion. For principle, the deflection was 1.61 plus or minus 0.4 arcseconds. They found the plus or minus turns indicates the amount of uncertainty in the results due to the kinds of errors mentioned above. For Zabel photographs taken with a smaller backup lens yielded a deflection of 1.98 plus or minus 0.18 seconds. Results clearly confirmed the light rays from the stars were deflected and bent during the eclipse, but they show only a rough agreement with Einstein's prediction of 1.75. On the other hand, the images are taken with a large astrograph at Sorabella and given a value of only 0.93 arcseconds, far too low to give credible support to Einstein. Einstein, however, had decided that this third result should be discarded, although the temperatures had fallen somewhat during the eclipse, causing the plates to shrink again. The result images were blurred, and there were great uncertainty as to how the expansion and the contraction had changed the scale. By discarding the blurred Sorbel data, Dyson had unwittingly left himself an engine open to accusation of bias or selective interpretation of the results. In 1979, however, astronomer Royal at the Royal Greenwich Observatory re-examined the discarded plates, using new equipment and new data analysis software to tease out the true and hidden data of blurred images. The Greenwich team showed that when all the scale and other technical errors were shifted out, the data has definitely favoured Einstein. Isn't that beautiful? It was the vindication of Dyson's decision that was brought to wider attention only in 2009 in a paper by Daniel Kendrick. It's certainly the uncertainty in experimental data can fuel a kind of anti-scientific bias we've seen in climate change debates. What lay people also misunderstand is the disagreement within the scientific community about the worth of an experimental test is not necessarily meant that the science and scientists can't be trusted. On the contrary, robust scientific scrutiny and debate are vital over the new results announced. Back in 1919, most scientists knew that despite the newspapers triumphed to the world, a new theory cannot overturn an existing one on the basis of a single test. Dyson himself planned a new expedition in time for the solar eclipse of September 2022, but was hampered by bad weather. However, a remote corner of northwest Australia had a special part to play in the retesting of Einstein's prediction during the eclipse of 1922. The US team from the Lick Observatory had made measurements during the 1918 eclipse, but Lick's director, William Campbell, was so concerned about accuracy that the results were not released. However, his interim data, analysed with the help of a female assistant, Adelaide Hobb, did not appear to favour Einstein's prediction. In September 2022, Campbell and some US colleagues joined a 20-person international team at Walla Downs, a cattle station on the coast of Port Hedland and Broome. Alexander David Ross, the lead Australian contingent, and there are two other Australian exhibitions, one in South Australia and one in Queensland. The teams had to deal with the same kinds of technical challenges of 1919, as well as flies and dust that brought their own crop of discomforts, according to Campbell. Fortunately, he also found that the hospitality and general interest shown by the astronomers was better than he experienced in any other part of the world on any other occasion. Not surprisingly, in 1922, measurements were no more accurate than those of 1919, but they did consist of far more data, and the best results gave an even better agreement with Einstein's prediction. Nevertheless, all up, the 1922 data was still too accurate and variable to give unequivocal support to Einstein's theory. The photographic exhibitions continued for the next half century. During the 1960s, the astronomers began testing Einstein's predictions using radio waves rather than light waves. Radio waves had the same electromagnetic radiation, and this is the speed of light, but they can be measured whatever their source, such as a quasar, passes behind the sun. There's no need to wait for an eclipse. In addition, they are not so vulnerable to atmospheric effects. Radio interferometry gives us a much more accurate data, And current errors are between plus and minus 1/10,000th of an arc second. And so far, the measured values have differed from Einstein's predictions by as little as 0.2%. This is several hundred times closer to the GR prediction than Einstein's result, which is far more with far more reliable data. In fact, the agreement is so good that astronomers are using gravitational lensing as a tool for exploring deeper into the cosmos. In the hunt for exoplanets, the analysis of dark matter, for example, while an ordinary lens uses refraction to bend and focus the light, astronomers use the gravitational bending of an electromagnetic rays by unknown objects to detect electromagnetic waves, radiation from sources too distant or hidden to see directly. A dramatic illustration is a stunning first direct image of the black hole, in which the radiation from the accretion disk is eclipsed by a massive hole. The halo and shadows are circular no matter which direction we're looking from, because gravity is so strong there that light paths are bent around the black hole, so all we can see is all sides. Isn't that amazing? That is just amazing. I didn't quite understand that before. All this new improved data shows two key things. First, that the 1919 tests were far from sufficient to have overthrown Newton and launched Einstein on his celebrity trajectory. Not only did they consist of just two independent experiments, Sorbel and Pincewell, they lacked both the technical accuracy and precise enough agreement with the new theory. The media razzmatazz was premature. Just as today, they are too often bombarded with premature announcements of various scientific and medical breakthroughs. What also gets lost is the kind of media hype is that no new theory has last word on reality. Eventually, GR will no doubt be adapted to give an even better fit with the physical observation, and perhaps an even better explanation found. For now, though, it's passed all the tests, and so the second thing that this data shows is that Einstein really does deserve his superstar status, and that Edison's faith in him was not misplaced. GR is truly extraordinary theory. It still offers our best explanation of the most accurate accounts of known gravitational effects, and has predicted the existence of completely new phenomena. In addition to light bending, many our predictions have confirmed, including the recent discovery of gravity waves and the gravitational redshift. This later effect is due to the slowing down of time of gravitational fields. Conversely, time speeds up in weaker fields, such as those experienced away from Earth and satellites, GPS navigation. This is a different, much larger effect from special relativity's time dilation due to the relative motion of the clock on the observer. Both effects are taken into account using GPS navigation. Without these corrections, our GPS positions would be out by a kilometre within 2 hours, and more than 10 kilometres a day. General relativity also opened up the whole field of cosmology and will continue to make headlines for some time yet. But the seeds of our confidence in Einstein's radical tour de force was planted, and Eddington and his colleagues obtained the very first broad confirmation of GR's prediction. Despite the limitations of the result, the 1919 exhibition was an amazing scientific undertaking, as centenary deserves to be celebrated. Well, that's beautiful. Robin Arendhod is adjunct research fellow at the School of Mathematical Science at Monash University. Her research fields are general relativity and the history of mathematical science. Well, she has written a fantastic year.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.